You are now entering the spoiler zone. The following podcast contains explicit plot details and pockets of profanity. You have been warned. The Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in wine and space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And it's time for the third of our Brexit specials. Yes, Brexit strikes back. It is, to be quite
boring
honest...
Boring the arse.
Well, the subject of Brexit, we've sort of been in it, through it, out the other side now, so this is a bit of a crowbar, really, to mop up a load of stuff that doesn't really fit anywhere else.
And it's the last one we're going to do.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to mop up yet, so don't never say never.
No, I am saying never. I'm bored to the arse of Brexit, and I don't want to do another one.
We're not talking about Brexit. We're just...
This is a Brexit special.
Yes.
We're talking about Brexit.
We're talking about European stuff.
Oh, no. We're going to be talking about the British government as well. If you're making me sit through this political shite, we are going to talk about the shower of shite we've got in government.
God. Whatever makes you happy. Can
Especially
we have a drink first?
Seeing as you told me earlier today that I didn't know what I was talking about when I said that the Prime Minister was lying.
I never said such a thing. I asked you for an example of what you were...
Anyway, I have examples.
We need a drink. Tonic screwdriver at the ready.
Something nice and European, please.
Nice and European. We have got...
Oh, German.
It is. It's a... I was about to say it's a 70% gin. No, it's not. It's a 70 cents a litre bottle.
Impressive.
41.5% gin. This is Tovis. Expertly distilled gin. A single batch crafted dry gin. And the info bollocks, which is... God almighty, copper writing on a green background, which is not good for the eyes... A high-quality, single-batch crafted dry gin that is infused with individually distilled lime and grapefruit peels, yielding a smooth gin with subtle citrus flavours. Thank you very much.
You do know that's not how you use glasses.
I know, but I don't need them, but that did help.
Right, okay, so.
Ooh.
Ooh, nice and grapefruity.
It is, coming out of the glass.
Ooh.
That's a bit different, but nice different.
That's lovely. I mean, you can taste the grapefruit, but it's blended into, and you can taste the lime as well. But there's something a bit more floral in here as well, isn't there?
Nothing's dominating. It's just a really nice blend of flavours.
Yeah, this is lovely. This has been really, really nicely blended. Well done, EU. I like this a lot. This is a 5.
I'm really tempted. I think I'm going to give it a 5, yes. That's beautifully different. And very refreshing. There's no nasty aftertaste, no bitterness, no sharpness.
Absolutely delicious.
Mm. So, let's walk down the steps into the under gallery. It's time to open up the Black Archive. Okay, well, just in general keeping with the theme, I'm going to plump for all the election footage over the years that is missing. In terms of a right riveting watch, it isn't. But it's there as a document of the time. I think the very first election that was covered by television was in 1951, which doesn't exist. And so few people had a television that it's not generally regarded to be anything like the election coverage we have these days. It was sort of, we got to the 59 election, that was when it was a little bit more akin to what we're used to. But footage like that we really should have in the archive as a historical record. What about you?
Well, I would like to have something back, in keeping with Brexit, that sadly we will never ever see again, and that's our international reputation and standing as a country.
Oh, for heaven's sake. The sky has not fallen in, you know.
The EU costs us £350 million a week that we can get back once we leave.
You mean that stupid bus thing?
Yes.
That was a colossal mistake. I don't know whose idea that was. No. Very, very bad move. The actual cost, because I worked this out, the actual cost of being in the EU, net... worked out at about £554 million. It cost us more than we paid in. The figure of £1 billion a month it costs us to be in the EU was bandied around. Technically true, but a lot of that was got back in grants and subsidies and what have you. But the actual cost was just over £500 million a month. So even assuming that it's £1 billion a month that it costs us, it's still not £350 million a week that we could channel into the NHS, and it was never going to happen. And I don't think many people were suckered in by that.
Oh, no, a lot of people were.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of the patients that I was looking after at the time in Stafford, they were saying, you'll be able to do so much better when you've got your 350 million, and saying it perfectly seriously. People believed this. You may not have done.
No, I any figure that's put in front of me as an election communique, I look at with very, very large pinches of salt. It's like when you get the figures banded around. Ah, yes, we're going to create 8,000 new jobs. Really, how many of those are part-time? How many of those are 0 hours? So whenever any development comes through on the planning portal, take all figures with a pinch of salt, because they're all... They're probably true, but a great big stretch of the truth to its very limits.
But there's exaggeration.
Mm.
And there's out-and-out fabrication. And the day after the referendum, Farage was on telly saying, well, we just made the figures up.
Well, I don't remember seeing that.
It was the next morning.
That one I'm going to have to look for, because that would be a clip... I suspect that they've been shared far and wide, but I will look for it. I will look for it. I'm not a great fan of Farage, so just because I've voted to leave, it doesn't mean I'm automatically a Farage supporter or a Boris supporter. Can we come out of the Black Archive now? I'd quite like to watch some telly. First up is it's a disc that you brought. It's never
that
been
narrow it down.
It doesn't as with a colossal stockpile. It's something that's never been released commercially. So this is an off-air copy of the Spitting Image Election Special, and I think it's the one from 1987. The one that I really want to see, and I'm sure it's out there somewhere, is the one from 92, which is the one I remember vividly. Spitting Image is always good for your money, so Ron VT.
And there we have it, the predicted result. Conservatives, 359 seats, Labour, 243 seats, and Alliance, 24 seats. The polls have now closed, shortly to be followed by the rest of the hospitals, the schools, and the BBC. Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha.
Oh my god, that was brilliant.
Was
absolutely wonderful. I'd forgotten just how uncompromising they were. We'll have to talk about that final sequence. The whole thing was brilliant. But the very end bit where they had the whole Conservative Party singing along to Tomorrow Belongs to Me. The Hitler Youth song from Cabaret, isn't it? And the little lad who's singing it does the Nazi salute at the end of it.
With a bowler hat and an umbrella and a pinstripe suit. The 1987 election was only ever going to go one way. And it was conservative for those that care. And the whole of this episode has played on it. Oh, gosh, I can't imagine ever being in a situation where a Labour just say the most populist thing they can think of at the time without having any real policies to back it up. But Margaret Thatcher is portrayed as this Churchillian in this iteration, because she went through quite a few different versions during the 80s on Spitting Image, but at this particular time they portrayed her in a pinstripe suit, shirt and tie with a cigar in a very Churchillian mould.
And they do this whole bit about Thatcher through time and the 2000 Thatcher.
Her voice getting higher, because when she first started she had quite a high-pitched voice, and they vocal coached her to...
But the final future Thatcher,
the future
voice
Thatcher
was Hitler.
Was the, yes, the Nuremberg Ram.
All the classics, the Ronald Reagan.
That was particularly brutal. Spitting Image never really pulled its punches, but that was bad.
Oh, the royals, the bit with the...
Princess Michael of Kent and...
And Prince Edward during his entertainment phase. And actually, that bit kind of reminded me of the Watch the Windsors. It predated all of that.
Have you seen any of the modern Spitting Image? The
no.
Rebooted? They're really good. They took a few episodes to find the feet,
I think it's on a streaming service. I don't have it home.
It's on BritBox at the minute. That is wasted on a streaming service. That should be, as it always was, Sunday night, 10 o'clock. That's the Spitting Image slot. The Merciless.
God, that was wonderful. And Norman Tebbit in a tank.
The good news is that
we've got all the names.
We've got all the names and addresses of people that haven't voted Conservative.
Alistair Burnett and his hamsterometer.
For those that aren't familiar with this,
perhaps we should explain what Spitting Image
is. I'm going to say Spitting Image is a puppet show from the 80s and 90s, predominantly political satire. But even if you don't recognise the figures themselves, the sketches, they still work quite well now. Even if you've just got a scant history of the political landscape during those periods, it doesn't really matter. The sketches are self-explanatory. And they're very funny all this year. 30, 40 years in the future, they're great.
Rent Boys.
Oh, the Rent Boys sequence. Oh, my. You had some politician from the time, who I think was Willie Whitelaw, but I can't swear to that. They're all on about creating jobs for the unemployed. And it's all to do with rent boys.
Yeah, don't just sit on your backside, sell it. David Steele, I've surged too soon.
That was another thing. The, in 1987, the current iteration of the Liberal Party in 1987 was a breakaway party from Labour called the SDP, or the SDLP.
Or the Alliance.
Or the Liberal Alliance. It went, even within its 5 or 6 year history, had about 4 or 5 name changes. But it was a political party that thought they could get away with having two leaders, David Owen and David Steele. Regrettably, David Steele was always portrayed on Spitting Image as being quite literally in the pocket of David Owen. And in that election, they went on about the surge. There's going to be a big surge towards the SDP that never happened.
My memory of David Owen on Spitting Image was him done up as Dracula.
No, you're misremembering that. That's something else.
I am. Been this election or the election before? I think it was the election before. There was not the 9 o'clock news, not the election special.
Ah, that was it. Yes.
And they did not the election special and they did not the royal wedding. And there were commemorative books for each of them and they were hilarious. And I lost my copies years and years and years ago. And in that, David Owen was Dracula.
Right. Yeah, because you have mentioned this before. I've got all the Spitting Image from the 80s. It was definitely never that. But I've been a huge fan of Spitting Image. I'm trying to track down all the copies. I've got the first sort of 13 series. The last 4 or 5 series have never been released commercially.
So when was the last time you saw that episode?
I don't ever think I've seen that one. That's the election special from 1987. They've never been released commercially, the specials. So I don't think I've ever seen that, but that was fantastic.
Because that was my off-air copy that I burnt onto DVD. Well, actually, it was my granddad's off-air copy, because he used to love Spitting Image. Which is why there are original adverts in there.
I know, weren't they great? So 80s.
Sort of spy, man of mystery, terribly dramatic advert that's for
Simonite car wax. The Gillette Blue 2 advert, I do remember.
Oh, I remember that one. Are you ready to get closer? Let's step into the blue, Gillette Blue 2. There was also Access.
I don't
access
the
flexible.
They didn't do the flexible friend thing. They didn't have the little white puppety thing that they used to do with Access.
Wasn't it stop motion rather than?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. The Access one, I don't remember. I do remember the NatWest with the light up buttons. What others were in there? There was.
At the end of a week full of clouded issues, you might appreciate a little clear analysis. Choose your words carefully. Ask for the Observer this Sunday.
There was an advert for a car.
Peugeot. Peugeot 309 GTI.
Thank you, eidetic memory.
No, my folks used to have a 309, I think. They went through a phase in the 80s of only driving Peugeots.
The lion goes from strength to strength.
Yes. Really incredibly nostalgic. There was the old TVS logo.
I miss all those regional things.
Because at the time this would have come out, we were living in 87, I'd have been 18. We were living in Dorset at the time.
Right.
I hated it. I fucking hated living in Bournemouth.
There is, as an aside, somewhere there was the best bit of graffiti I've ever seen. Oh, there's two actually, but they're both on a road sign. One way it said, Dover for the continent. The other way it said Bournemouth. Somebody had scrawled underneath for the incontinent. And the other one was when I was working in France. There was a sign for Nice, and underneath someone had spray-painted One Cyril. A gas advert, Nice One Cyril. Am I misremembering that? It was some advert from the 80s.
Nice One Cyril, let's have another one.
Which one, what was it for?
I can't remember.
Do write in. Anyway, next up, we're moving on to the continent now. I'm going to put on an episode of a series called KYTV. Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard of it because you talk about it a lot, but I haven't seen it.
KYTV was a television spin-off of a long-running radio series called Radioactive.
Radioactive, I know.
Yeah. Well, it's the same cast, the same characters, but translated from a radio station to a fledgling satellite TV station.
Right. Okay.
Angus Deaton's in it, Jeffrey Perkins, Michael Fenton Stevens, Philip Pope.
So is it a hat trick?
I think it's pre-hat trick. I just think.
Didn't Hat Trick come out the back of Who Dares Wins?
I thought Hat Trick was on the back of Have I Got News For You, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
No.
But it's the same stable
Have
of
I Got
people.
News For You was a Hat Trick production. They all got their start in Who Dares Wins.
I don't know it.
I've got Who Dares Wins with me. We'll do that. Terry and Wang Wang.
That's the panda, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was where that whole slew of comedians. So it was Rory McGrath, Philip Pope, Jimmy Mulville.
Ian Hislop?
No, Tony Robinson.
Tony Slattery?
No, not Tony Slattery. They're Time Team blokey.
Oh, so that is Tony Robinson, yeah.
Yeah, and Julia Hills.
Oh, right.
It's brilliant. It used to be absolute Friday night getting in from the pub, watching.
But for the moment, an episode from series 2 of KYTV. It ran for 3 series in the early 90s. And this one is called Good Morning Calais.
Before we do KY and swing over the channel.
Oh, hello.
I think we need some snackettes.
We do.
And I happen to have French-themed snackettes. We have the French kitchen look, hand-cooked potato crisps, snail and garlic flavour. Now, snail always reminds me of my sort of relative who isn't, who lives in France. And she and her non-husband live at one of, I think there's only 11 official Roquefort farms, and they run one of them. He's very, very proud of his Roquefort cheese. He makes enormous omelettes with massive amounts of Roquefort cheese. They're revolting because I don't like Roquefort in the first place. Would you like a snail crisp? They don't smell of snails.
No, I detest snails. It's one of the very few things that I really don't enjoy eating. But
You'll be fine. They don't taste of snails. It tastes quite odd.
A sort of cream cheese and chive.
No, there's a lot of garlic in there.
I can't say that I'd gravitate. They're not bad. I can't say that I'd...
All right. They're better.
Well, they're suitably French-themed crisps.
You see, I like snails.
No, it's not.
And give Karen her juice. She can cook a nice snail.
It's way too much effort.
Oh, it takes her all day. Well, that's quite good, because she's in the kitchen all day. That means I don't have to talk to her. She and I don't get on terribly well. And now that we're officially not related anymore, I don't have to talk to her. I come from a complicated family.
Let's uncomplicate things. Ron VT, Good Morning Calais.
Many people over here are worried that European unity will in fact mean a European takeover of this country. And right now I'm joined by one of the architects of the new Europe, the distinguished German statesman Adolf Hitler. Helmut Brandt. So, Helmut, will there be a German takeover of this country?
What makes you think that?
Well, this EC plan of the next stage of the single market. Dr. Matthews, how do you feel about European unity?
Oh, let's face facts. The Krauts can't be trusted, the Wops march backwards into battle, and the greasy frogs will sleep with anyone who'll buy them dinner.
Yes. So you think that an isolationist policy is justified because it allows greater independence to each country, and therefore greater freedom?
Now, you're deliberately pregseeing my remarks to make a logical and coherent argument, and I won't stand for it.
Yes, well, thank you, Dr. Matthews.
No, I haven't finished yet.
Common agricultural policy. Thought that would do it.
Well, that was KYTV, Good Morning Calais, from 1992.
That was marvellous.
I'm glad you thought so, because it was a staple for me when I was at high school. I used to look forward to this when it was on. The first two series were on DVD. I think the third one did come out, but it was very quickly withdrawn. It's worth a small fortune now. It's set in a satellite station in the early 90s, loosely modelled on Sky Television.
Would it have been BSB at that point?
No, there was BSB and Sky. They were competing until Sky just bought them out and it became B Sky B.
With the Squareels.
With the Squareels. A horrific appendage to any house. That's one of the better episodes. I really, really like that.
That was wonderful. That was really entertaining. The bit where the English presenter was interviewing the German bloke and they start translating for each other and end up with the German fellow speaking English and the British presenter speaking German. That was so cleverly written.
Yeah.
It was absolutely brilliant.
A lot of this has been lifted because all of the KYTV episodes, I think, or a great number of them, were all rewrites of radio episodes. Yeah. So this one they did do. It was a Euro episode. So a lot of this has been translated straight from that, but it works so well. In fact, some of it works better on television.
Yeah, some of the Vox Pop stuff they did. Oh, and that Going for Gold. Because Going for Gold itself was dreadful.
Oh, there was Henry Kelly.
Yeah. And it was every bit as cringeworthy to the Europeans.
Yeah. This episode does trade on British nationalism towards Europe, even back then. And it's very, very relevant, actually. Bear in mind that this is nearly 30 years ago.
Yeah, but the arch-conservative that they've got is saying exactly the same thing that supporters of our government say now.
Didn't you mind being a little bit tarring everybody with the same brush? I don't think everybody thinks that way, you know.
No,
just
I
because
don't
they
think...
happen to vote a certain way.
I don't think everybody thinks that way. If we look at the referendum, it was very, very, very close.
It was, as all referendums are. This is why we don't have them very often, because yes. They just divide things horribly.
And it's why it was a terrible idea and should never have been implemented.
Moving on. Moving on. Another terrible idea. I've never seen this, but even the DVD box looks terrible. It's Curry and Chips.
Oh dear God.
Yeah. Even
can
the
we
DVD...
not talk about KYTV some more? I've seen an episode of Curry and Chips. It's terrifyingly bad.
You've mentioned it before, and I think in a previous Brexit episode, and I've seen the DVD in your colossal archive, and now copies.
Yeah, because I never throw anything away. I've only watched one episode of it. It's...
There is examples of TV. They're not... just because something's in the collection doesn't mean it's a firm favourite, but it does look appallingly bad. Do you want to give us a little bit of background on Curry and Chips?
Not really. I don't particularly want to watch it.
We're going to do it because it just looks so appalling.
Right, it was a Spike Milligan vehicle from the late 60s. I think it was written by Johnny Spate. It's certainly racist enough. And it was Spike Milligan as a Pakistani Irishman. Mm.
This is not going to be good, is it?
And he has some horrifically racist name. It's Seamus Khan or something like that. It's awful. It's absolutely awful. Yeah, rip the plaster off. Get it on the DVD and get it over with.
Oh, Ron VT on episode one.
And only episode one.
Look what the cat's dragged in.
Hello, Tom, Young Dick.
Hello, you Tom, know, Young Dick. Hello, Tom, Dick.
Kevin O'Grady.
Kevin or what?
Supposed to be Irish.
Which part of Ireland are you from? Burnt Cork?
I'm from Pakistan. Pakistan's not in Ireland. Pakistan's in bloody India, mate.
Oh, no, Pakistan is not in India, mate. Pakistan's in bloody Pakistan, mate.
What are we having to drink?
I don't know. I am not used to the drink. That proves he's not a mick for a start off.
What are you having to drink, lad?
Well, if he's a mick, give him a Guinness.
Pint a bitter for me and a Guinness and what, Tom? And
well, look, I have
cheers.
Ah, why you give me black drink?
That was spectacularly bad. I think I'd go so far as to say that's the worst thing we've ever watched in one of these sessions.
I don't know what to say. I'm not convinced that I've ever actually made it through the entire first episode because, oh, Jesus, all the stuff in the pub and the boarding house afterwards, I don't remember at all. That was painful to watch.
The premise of the episode is that a Pakistani comes over to work in a factory And for some bizarre reason, he's been written as having Irish heritage and going by an Irish name, which...
Which is convoluted. Wanting to be weird.
The cast is, you know, it's quite a good cast. You've got Eric Sykes, Spike Milligan, Jeffrey Hughes is in it. Kenny Lynch is in it, which that's a problem, I didn't realise. And it's basically this Pakistani trying to integrate into the British workforce who want nothing to do with him, really. Bear in mind, I was only born in 1978. But this is sort of racial prejudices and stereotyping ramped up to 11.
Yeah, there's one bit where he's taking on a room at the boarding house and the...
The landlady says, no coloureds.
No, I'll charge the coloureds rate.
Yeah, which for the period, that wouldn't have been uncommon.
Yeah.
This is 1969. It thankfully, mercifully, only ran for one series. The last episode was broadcast on Boxing Day, 1969. What a treat that must have been. You can see underlying running through it. Eric Sykes' character, the factory foreman, for the most part of it, is sympathetic. And then
it's lip service sympathy, because he does come out with lines like, it better not be dark because I won't see him.
But all that sympathetic character evaporates in the last 5-10 minutes when he gets it into his head because of an off-the-cuff remark from Kenny Lynch's character. Pakistanis, they're all gay and believe that in their religion men are going to give birth to a baby eventually. So, you know, watch your step. So the last quarter of the episode is Eric Sykes running around covering his arse in increasingly... It's just all... Underlying the whole thing is... A dig at
any kind of integration.
British racial bigotry and
well,
but it's just so clumsily done.
I'm not sure that it's a dig at it, because I've said this before about Johnny Spate and the whole thing about Alf Garnett being a spokesman character, and it's the character that is making the comments, not the writer. But if your entire career is based around writing horrific bigots, the apple don't fall far from that particular tree.
I wouldn't like to say I don't know anything about Johnny Spate beyond what... I don't know. But all I do know is that whatever the message that's trying to be conveyed here, it's appallingly done. That was just dreadful television. On any level, that was just bad. It wasn't funny. The lines weren't well written. They weren't particularly well delivered, if I'm honest. Every single character in it is hateful.
Yeah. And with Spike Milligan, you expect... anarchy and energy and the Q series and all of that, and to an extent uncontrollable. He's phoning in his performance.
Yeah.
How this got commissioned, and I know we've said this about a lot of other things, but how this got commissioned, I have no idea. Because it's not even hanging on to the coattails of Alf Garnett. Or is it?
Alf Garnett would have come before this. But actually, Spike Milligan's character, I've just been reading the Wikipedia entry, he appeared in Till Death Us Do Part as this character afterwards.
But from the opening sequence, even the title sequence is horrific.
Oh, the title sequence is awful. It's awful. It's Spike Milligan doing cod packets. Oh, I can't even go into it. It's just dreadful.
He turns up having been sent by the...
Was it the Labour Exchange?
By the Labour Exchange. To work in this factory making novelty goods. And the shop steward basically says, well, we've got our coloureds quota. Sack Kenny Lynch, you can have this one. And then Kevin O'Grady saves things by saying, I'm Irish, I'm not a bloody walker. And it's just, oh my God.
But every single character is dialed up to 11 racist. So there's no balance. It's just every single character
even is... Kenny Lynch's character.
Even Kenny Lynch. Eric Sykes, for most of the episode, you sort of vaguely... Yeah. He's a vaguely sympathetic one. And then even he just degenerates at the end. And you don't like Spike Milligan's portrayal as the Pakistani fella. So there's just nobody in it to like at all. There's nothing in there that's positive that you can latch onto or identify with. It's...
horrific.
That was the worst thing I've ever seen. I mean, you know me. I view television from the sort of 60s and 70s as of their time. There's language that you'd never use now. There are attitudes that aren't prevalent now. But you gloss over those. They're usually done in such a way that that is the character you're laughing at. But you're not even laughing at these characters. They're just hateful. I am not one for censorship or cancelling something because it's a little bit offensive. This isn't a little bit offensive.
I wouldn't want to censor this. I wouldn't want to make it unavailable, because it does demonstrate quite how horrific things could be at that time.
Yeah.
But I don't want to watch any more.
But I don't think that things were ever that horrific. And every single person in this is just openly hostile and abusive to this Pakistani fella. And
yeah, who himself is hostile and offensive and racist. He said, I left Pakistan because there were too many wogs.
Yes. This is the most hateful thing I've ever watched. I just no interest in ever seeing that again. I'm glad we've done it just to see how bad TV can get. The fact that six episodes of this were even made is just a mystery. Surely as they were cutting it together, or the programme planners watching it before they went out, surely someone somewhere must have thought, it's not our best.
So, null point.
Null point for curry and chips.
Or minus several million point. I hated that. I really hated that.
That was awful.
But one of the things that it did mention at the beginning was Enoch, Mr. Powell himself.
Yes.
So to lead into our final segment, we have the David Frost interview with Enoch Powell.
Is this the Rivers of... No, it's not the River. That was a speech.
No, that was a speech.
That was a speech.
But I think this is fairly soon after the Rivers of Blood speech.
Right.
So that's going to be another cheery watch.
Well, we usually finish these Brexit things with something very downbeat and serious, so let's not break the tradition of a trio.
There might be one extra little thing after the Enoch Powell thing.
Oh, well,
I'll keep that as a surprise.
Marvellous. It's Ron VT, David Frost and Enoch Powell.
The Conservative opposition was going to vote against the race relations bill on the ground that it would do more harm than good. Now, one of the reasons, indeed the main reason, why it would do more harm than good was that it was going to give the native population, the indigenous population, call them what you will, the sense that it was they who were being put in the dock and discriminated against. Now, in order to bring home to the vast majority of people who have no direct experience of what happens where the immigrant population extends, it was necessary to reflect the mood, the experiences, the feelings of the people who do live in those areas.
But you might just as well, if you're going to use the word typical like that, you might just as well say the British Olympic team are typical of the British people. They're all being flown to Mexico to compete in throwing the hammer.
But do you really disbelieve that in the areas where the immigrant population is taking over, and I use the word quite neutrally, one street, one area after another, do you doubt that over and over and over again, experiences like these are suffered by women exactly like that person? If you don't, then go and ask the police. Go and make inquiries. You don't even need to do that. Read the Milner-Holland report of, what, 4 or 5 years ago on housing in London, and you will find case after case similar to the one which I quoted listed in that official report.
So I come back to the basic typical.
Right, so that was an interview in the Frost on Friday strand on the 3rd of January 1969 between David Frost and Enoch Powell. And it came about 10 months after his famous Rivers of Blood speech, which he never referred to as the Rivers of Blood
speech. He never did, and there's only one river in it. The River Tiber is the only one that's mentioned in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Enoch Powell was a Conservative politician of the 1960s. He'd been a member of the Cabinet. He'd been a member of the Shadow Cabinet. He actually lost his place in the Shadow Cabinet in the aftermath of the Rivers of Blood speech. He was a very accomplished man. He'd been a classical scholar and was a full professor of Greek, I think in Australia, wasn't it?
Yes.
By the time he was 25, he was fluent in multiple ancient languages. He was a translator. He had a very distinguished war record. And he was very opposed to the race relations bill. He was anti-immigration. He supported the then proposed policy of the Conservative Party that the people that we would now know as the Windrush generation be repatriated. It's a little harsh to call it an interview because it's very confrontational.
Yes.
But the conversation that we've just seen between David Frost and Enoch Powell, I don't think David Frost comes out looking particularly well because all he is doing is barracking.
It's a technique that's not used overly nowadays, but Frost was, I mean, it was very confrontational right from the start. It was only ever going to go in one direction. But he used an old interview technique of picking on one word and repeating it over and over again. And in this case, it was the first one he exactly used was typical, a word that Enoch Powell had used regarding a hate crime in his constituency. And David Frost just picked and picked and picked on this, and it got very irritating very quickly.
Yeah.
Because it was clearly taken wildly out of context. And Frost, he was interrupting all the time so that Enoch Powell couldn't give a full answer to any question.
Where you quoted those figures from The mm-hmm. Lancet about the birth rate... Yes. In Wolverhampton, yes. In the very same paragraph,
yes.
It went on yes. to say the incredibly high figures of the medical yes, services yes. in Wolverhampton that were staffed by coloured people. Same paragraph, same line.
I'll tell you why I didn't. Because the people who are staffing the hospitals, let's take doctors first, are not immigrants. They are not people who have come here to settle. In fact, many of them are not Commonwealth citizens at all. Many of them are from overseas countries which are not Commonwealth countries and who have therefore not got the right anyhow, never had it, to immigrate. Their average length of stay in this country is 2 to 3 years. Consequently, to treat them as immigrants in the sense of the immigrant population, which is producing 23% of the births, is a falsification and can only give rise to misunderstanding.
But you said about, in building up to that figure you see of 23%, you said this high birth rate was due to their habits, as if they breed like rabbits.
You've put words in my mouth, which you will now claim are typical.
No.
No, do you not think that was deliberate?
Oh, it's an old interview technique, yes.
And he was up against somebody who was a very skilled orator.
Yes.
And that really comes across just how intelligent and accomplished and coherent an orator and a debater Enoch Powell is.
We've discussed this over this weekend regarding politicians who are interviewed and don't have a full command of the facts. Now, Enoch Powell, he felt very passionately about this. His constituency, it had a heavy immigrant population, and that was part of the reason why he made speeches regarding immigration and had strong views on it. It affected his constituents. But on the other hand, he was fully conversant with all the facts, and they were fired back at him out of context by Frost. And he just put them, he said, these are all out of context. This is the context. And if you extrapolate this information in the context, how it was made and what it actually means. In actual fact, the figures that he quoted or that were projected for the year 2000 were actually pretty spot on.
I mean, the thing that he didn't take into account and didn't predict was that there would be integration between populations. And he was seeing it as very much an us and them. Whereas that's
sort of. I'm not sure that's entirely fair.
He mentioned nothing at all about integration. It was very much the immigrant population, the native population.
It agreed.
What has actually happened in time is that there's an awful lot of integration between those two populations, which he didn't address there. There's another interview which I think he comes off better, because there's less barracking between him and Jonathan Miller. And I'd quite like to do that before we finish.
Absolutely.
And I know we're drifting way away from Brexit.
But it's pertinent to the theme.
I mean, that interview was supposed to be one of the high points in David Frost's interviewing career. And I don't think he came across particularly well because he was so confrontational.
Yeah.
And confrontational interview style can work, but you actually have to give the person that you're asking the question the opportunity to answer it, and he didn't.
No, he didn't. He just kept talking over absolutely everything and interrupting the answers and taking out of context. And once you start doing that in that particular style, it automatically puts the viewer on the side of the interviewee.
At the beginning, I kind of got the impression that the audience was all going to be on David Frost's side.
So did I, but it turns out
some of the comments that were shouted in made it clear that there were a significant number of people on Enoch Powell's side.
He had a lot of respect across the House. Tony Benn, a Labour MP, had an awful lot of time for Enoch Powell and said that he was the least racist man he ever met. And the problem that it triggered up in context at the time, is that Enoch Powell said things that were being thought privately up and down the country, but were not actually being addressed. And the problem, this could be any political issue, until it's addressed, a lot of things are sort of, that's not really a problem if we never talk about it.
Yeah.
And inevitably, somebody somewhere eventually was going to say, well, should we have a look at immigration? I'm not saying it was entirely a flawless way of going about it, but it was one of those things that did need addressing. And in many ways, the facts and figures that he were quoting and the fears and concerns that he was raising have actually turned out to be quite well-founded. I'm not saying that the streets are awash with blood, but I don't think it's a bad thing to raise fears about something that all indicators are that there's going to be a problem down this direction. Do you not think we should probably have a look at it?
I think there was a very telling thing towards the end where he point blank refused to offer any reassurance to the immigrant population.
The question that you're on about, it was to whites and blacks. I mean, everything that he said, I've got to say, if I was in his position, I'd probably have adopted the same position. They were trying to back him into a corner and say something that he would deeply regret in future. And he was skilled enough to see it coming and avoid either.
Well, I appreciate that bit. What I'm saying is that had he been a representative or a spokesman for his entire constituency, and part of his point was that his constituency now had a very significant immigrant population. As their MP, he should be representing their interests as well. And there was nothing of that that came across. And he didn't come across as somebody who was prepared to reassure the immigrant population.
With that specific point, I think the problem is he was literally just getting to that. They'd clearly run out of time for the programme. The commercial break was
very late. And they were saying, we're trying to get more time, we're trying to get more time. And he was still answering the question as the credits rolled.
As the credits rolled, and he was cut off just as he was getting to exactly the point that you've raised.
But do you not think that was deliberate? And he was skillfully...
Personally speaking, no, because he didn't shy away from that. He was... If Frost hadn't interrupted as much as he did while he was trying to answer that fucking question, we would have got a full answer out of him.
Or we'd have got a longer preamble until the credits.
I've seen plenty of politicians' interviews where they do waffle and stonewall, and you think, you look awful.
Doing it very intelligently. And after a minute, I mean, politics aside, he came off as a very skillful speaker and orator and debater. And David Prost came across kind of petulant.
Say something in case we've got to just finish now and can't go on. Given that coloured people will always be in this country, they won't all leave, right? Whatever happens to your proposals, right? Do you agree with that?
To the party's proposals for repatriation?
Yes. Yes. There will always be coloured people in this country, right?
As there always have been.
Yes. Say something.
It's a matter of numbers.
Say something to the white people and the coloured people. What's the most important thing in order to get... Leaving aside how many you hope will leave or anything like that, what's the most important thing to make them live together happily?
The absence of fear that the number of coloured...
All right,
of immigrant...
No. I'm asking, I'm asking now for... You've never, ever given a positive, warm bit of advice of the way that blacks and whites should behave together.
But I live...
Do it, please.
I'm very much obliged to you, but I'll answer it my own way if you don't mind.
All right.
And I live in a constituency in which the behaviour of the white population towards the increasing number of immigrants has been tolerant beyond all praise and beyond, I must confess, beyond all expectation. I would be ashamed of myself to go preaching to them about tolerance and how to behave. But if you ask me, what is the essential thing for peace? It is that the fear of a continuous and large increase in the numbers of the immigrants should
be. I was actually surprised. There was one particular camera angle. It was a two-shot, and I was surprised at how close together they were. Mm-hmm. It was very sort of pointy finger in your face, within inches of each other.
Yeah. And David Frost's body language was very uncomfortable. It was very squirmy and closed and tied in.
David Frost was out of his depth, though. He was up against a formidable opponent,
yes.
I should say.
I agree. Which is why I'd quite like to just see and comment on the discussion between Enoch Powell and Jonathan Miller, which is two people of more
calm disposition.
Comparable intellect, I was going to say, but...
I have seen fragments of this, but it'd be interesting to see the whole thing.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
So let's Ron VT.
Are you worrying about the increase in numbers or the increase in the number of people who the population at large feel anxious about because of some certain recognisable feature?
Yes.
Have features which are... like.
Of course, we are not concerned with the increase in the total population from, say, 55 to 60 million.
Mm-hmm.
We are concerned with the increase in an element of a population which is profoundly different, thinks itself different, is seen as different from the rest. And that is where the significance both of number and of concentration comes in. Now, it could be as serious, indeed it could be more serious, if that different population were white and not coloured. I can well imagine that if they were, for example, Germans or Russians who were going to be occupying two-fifths or a half of Birmingham at the beginning of the next century, we should... Yes, in occupation, living
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
In the case of Birmingham, it will be at least two-fifths. We'll be occupied by the immigrants and their descendants by the early years of the next century.
Yeah, above all, their descendants.
Yes, indeed. Yes, but those descendants will still be thoroughly separate, for the most part, from the rest of the population because of the numbers. If the numbers were small, then, of course, like any very small minority, they would filter into the population. But nobody seriously imagines that if two-fifths of Birmingham consists of a first generation of descendants born here, of people from the West Indies, from Africa, and from Asia, there will not be a profound difference between that part of the population and the rest.
I think there may be a difference. In fact, there certainly will be a difference. Whether that difference is enough to promote anxiety, unless someone declares...
You think nobody would notice?
No, I think they'll notice, certainly. The question about is whether they will notice with fear and horror unless someone announces to them that fear and horror are an appropriate response to such a fact.
I see. And you think that human nature is such that unless somebody referred to this, nobody would notice that their own native cities were transformed, that the white population was moving out and a different population was moving in.
I didn't say that.
Well, you think then that it would be noticed, but that it would not be merely be tolerated, but would be taken as a desirable or acceptable development.
No, I didn't say that either.
Well, that is what you have to say. You have to say, if this is not to be a problem.
No.
That was an interview with Enoch Powell and with Jonathan Miller on something called The Dick Cavett Show.
It was a big interviewer in America, ran throughout the sort of 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that looks as though it was sort of mid-70s.
Early 70s, I would say, yeah.
But certainly a good few years after the interview that we'd just seen with David Frost. I think that was a much, much better interview.
Yes, it was.
The interviewer had sense enough to realise he was massively outclassed by both of his guests and just let them talk rather than barrack them. The question of racism was again raised with Enoch Powell, and this is where I disagree with what you said before about how he was about to give an answer and the credits rolled. He spent 10 minutes not answering that question. At no point did he address racism. He went into a long speech about British history and the history of immigration, but at no point did he address the question that he was asked.
He was asked, is he a racist? And agreed, yes, he didn't directly answer that question.
What he said was that we need to define what racism is. And then he went into a long talk about British history and never actually defined it.
That's true, yes.
So I don't think extra time in that David Frost interview would have made any difference at all. He would have just gone into another long speech about something tangential, which is what that was.
Sort of, but the question that he was actually answering at the end of the David, he was clearly starting to talk about it as the programme cut off, which was, what message would you give to people? And he was cut off twice.
Yeah, but that...
Just as he was saying about the spirit of cooperation.
Or just as he looked as though he was going to say something, because he knew that the programme was coming to an end. That was a kind of television filibustering. He was avoiding answering that question, and he avoided answering the question with more skill, because he had to do it for longer, on that Dick Cavett show.
On Are You a Racist?
Which is a similar question to what he was asked to. What reassurance would you give to both sides?
Well, it's not really.
Yeah, it is.
Those are totally... Well, I would answer those differently. But there were certain moments in that that were a little bit cringeworthy and a little bit egotistical. But I thought Jonathan Miller's interjections were... They actually weren't very helpful. A lot of the time, Jonathan Miller comes across as very pompous and it's one-sided, that this is the right view. I had to sort of inwardly smirk at one point where he says, you're asking me to look at both sides of the argument and take on their failings as well. Well, yeah, you can't just pick sides. It was...
Well, he's a philosopher, so the whole point is not to pick sides. And I thought that was quite interesting because he was challenging Enoch Powell, but he was doing it from a very intellectual perspective.
But it was quite a pompous perspective, and
a lot of intellectuals are, and... Enoch Powell was replying with every bit as much intelligence, but from a much more populist perspective, which is why I was getting the claps from the audience and things. Again, body language difference between the two. Enoch Powell looked completely comfortable.
He did.
Just there, relaxed, chatting away, calm, almost fey voice. Jonathan Miller, tied up in knots and not making eye contact with anybody, looking very uncomfortable, and at some point was actually closing his eyes, presumably to formulate his thoughts. The questions he was coming out with were relevant and cogent, but very academically posed.
Mm.
He was primarily an academic.
Yes.
So his experience was to formulate very precise and specific questions. Mm. And I've no doubt that Enoch Powell knew what he was doing. He was just better at fudging answers because that was his job as a politician.
But I still think that's a little bit unfair because he did...
Well, there were some things that he answered and he bounced back when he could, but there were... Throughout both of those interviews, there were big chunks of things that he didn't answer. And he went into a long way around the houses.
Yes.
The racism one is a perfect example. That was 10 minutes of British history and very one-sided. Jonathan Miller comes in and says, well, actually, you're not talking about this at all from the Indian perspective. And then Enoch Powell comes out with the whole, the Indians loved us being there.
That I disagree with strongly. Yeah.
You talk to anybody who's actually from India, and particularly older generations from India, and that is not the truth.
That is not the truth. No, yeah. I don't.
The whole thing about you had to learn Urdu to go and serve there, I don't think is true.
No. But the only thing I will say regarding his answers, when you're in that sort of position, and bear in mind, I've been in that position a lot, you have to give the answer you want to give in order to say what you need to say, because they're not going to ask you the questions that give you the opportunity to say what needs to be said. Everything that Enoch Powell said in that needed to be said to give context to the ramifications and the upshot of that speech. So it gave contextualised history of the situation. It was far better than just simply, are you a racist then? Well, no, I'm not. All right, and then going to something else. You never get the contextualised history.
Yeah, I mean, there's contextualised history, and then there's a 10-minute one-sided view of the history of the partition of India.
Right, take the partition of India bit out of it, but the rest of it, the numerical breakdown, is absolutely spot on. That's what happened. Everybody within the empire had a British passport. They came and went, and they weren't counted as immigrants because technically they weren't.
Because they weren't. And now what I have to say, it was a very impressive... Both of those interviews with Enoch Powell were very impressive masterclasses in political answers to questions. And I have to say, I'm very thankful that we don't have anybody of his calibre in the current government, because the impression that you get coming from him, I don't agree with his views, but I am very impressed by his intelligence and his debating skills. And the fact that I believe that he was doing what he thought was right.
Well, yes.
I think the same thing about Margaret Thatcher. I don't agree with her policies. Mm. I don't agree with what she did. I thought that a lot of it was very short-sighted and damaging. But I have no doubt that her motivation was what she thought was the best thing for the country.
Whereas the flip side of that coin is that I agree with Enoch Powell. I don't agree with Enoch Powell. I just think he raised some very pertinent points that really needed to be raised. And a lot of what he foresaw is actually true. Whether it's palatable or not, or in polite society, it doesn't. It's like any number of other topics. You can't say that. Just because something is unpalatable, ignoring it or not talking about it doesn't make it less true.
Yeah. What he doesn't predict, and Jonathan Miller was trying to get him to talk about, and he wouldn't, was integration. And he was very much this is going to be the way things are, and you cannot possibly believe that it's going to be anything other than an us and them.
Again, but that is demonstrably true to an extent.
To an extent, but there's also a very large amount of integration.
There is, but just because part of something is working well doesn't mean you can ignore the bit that isn't working well. There is massive racial segregation in the UK, and it tends to be in very concentrated areas. So Birmingham's mentioned a lot. Blackburn, just down the road, is a case in point. Very, very segregated. And again, from personal experience, unfortunately, let's take Muslim communities, for example. They're very, very reluctant to integrate. It is their way or no way. There's no sort of middle ground. Mm. Now, what you've got now is an attitude from, I don't want to say English people or white, the majority of the population are decent people who will, you know, go halfway, at least with somebody else's culture, to be respectful and to adapt to their way of life. If somebody, you know, if you go into a place of worship, you have to take your shoes off. You refuse to take your shoes off. Well, you're the knob, mate, not them. With something like the Muslim community, There's no halfway point coming towards Western culture. It is their way, and that's the end of that. That is where the problems come in, when you've got one side, and it doesn't matter which side it is, that will not change. And in that, he talks about a 2/5 population of Birmingham being of immigrant stock and their descendants. All of a sudden, you've got 2/5. If their habits and their culture is vastly different from the rest, and there's no movement to integrate, you do have that us and them situation, and it's only going to get worse.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think there is a move to integrate. Now, what you were saying in a different context is that you're always going to have people who will have very fixed and rigid views.
Yes, yes.
And that's on both sides of the fence.
It is, yes.
But as more generations come through, there is more integration.
I would like to think so. Well, I really would. We're still a long way from where I would have hoped us to be, considering that, you know, the first proper wave of immigration came in after the Second World War to basically rebuild the entire country.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that we've seen this evening are reasons why that integration isn't happening. I mean, curry and chips, for as much as I hated it, and it was caricature, there was a lot of that kind of feeling.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. But I think that's the extreme
Johnny
end
Spade
of the
was
scale.
Popular because he wrote things that people identified with. Not so much curry and chips, that was absolute caricature, but Alf Garnett.
Yes, and you still have, in predominantly the elder end of the population, you still have your Alf Garners. Send them back to where they came from.
I don't think it's predominantly the elder population. It's the generation below that. It's your 60 to 70 group.
Yes.
Yeah, 80s, 90s, the ones who actually fought the war.
Yes.
Are generally very tolerant. Mm. It's the generation that come after that, your Little Britainers, who say, we fought the war for this. And
yes.
Actually, mate, you didn't fight anything. Your parents fought the war, and you might find that they're really quite pissed off about what you're saying.
Yeah.
They can hear it. My mum is more racist than my grandparents ever were. Not in terms of language, but in terms of attitude.
Mm.
I don't ever remember her using the N-word other than to describe a colour of brown, but she did used to call people Black Bess, which made me cringe. But she didn't have any problem talking to anybody. Mm. I mean, she didn't particularly like people, so she didn't have friends. But when she was out and about and engaging with people, and she loved going around antique shops and junk shops and stuff, and it didn't matter who was running it. It could be somebody Indian, it could be somebody Black. She didn't care. She treated them exactly the same. My mum's attitude is, oh, I like these Indian people, but they have their own country.
I think that attitude is dying out.
Yeah, because then we've got our generation who are coming along, where there has been a few generations of integration, and we've grown up with Indian friends and Black friends and whatever, and don't see it as any different. And there is a degree of colourblindness.
Mm.
Now, talking to Dean,
who's on the Rose episode,
she made me realise that colourblindness itself is only a first step. And actually, you need to go beyond colourblindness and recognise that there are differences between the population, but that doesn't stop integration.
Well, I would agree with that to a point. I mean, I was very fortunate and flattered that I was seeing a Muslim woman last year for a good few months. But the cultural differences were not from her. They were from her community. And the barriers that are put up to integration, the changes that I was expected to make to integrate with their society, and they do, or this particular community certainly, classed itself as its own sort of community. You know, I would have to give up alcohol, I would have to give up pork products, I would have to convert to being a Muslim, we don't date, we marry, we don't do this, we don't do that, you will have to change your job. And this list, this great categorical list of what I will have to do to change, to be acceptable to their community, was everything that is, I hesitate to say British values, but they are the way of the country. Now, in the end, I just said, you know, please just take a step back here and look at what you're asking. What am I asking you to change in order to integrate with my society? And she came back and said, well, you know, how would your friends and family feel if you took it? I said, nobody would care. Well, nobody who counts. So the integration, I'm all for it. I think it would be a better society for it. If we could sort of have this fusion of cultures, I think we'd be a much better society for it. But I personally have this horrible feeling that now the refusal to integrate is actually coming the other way. That's what needs to be addressed. And you can't say that without, well, you're just a racist bigot for saying that. I now have first-hand experience of it, unfortunately, whereas before I didn't think that that existed. And I don't know, maybe I was a freak isolated example. But integration does need to move both ways.
Yes, and is a thing that takes generations.
Yes.
It's like any kind of societal change or acceptance of minority groups. Mm. So we're what, over 100 years since universal suffrage?
Yes.
But there is still a glass ceiling.
I don't doubt that there are elements of it still in the workplace. I think that they are getting massively fewer and further between.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's taken 100 years to do that. And so other forms of integration and normalisation that have come since then are likely to take a similar amount of time. And if there
isn't it depressing, though, a century?
Yeah.
70 years since the war and we're still sort of integrating. Isn't that long enough?
Well, no, because it takes generations.
I know, but... Yeah. Society moves at a depressingly slow pace for me.
Yeah. This isn't something that's going to happen in our lifetimes. Mm. Have we moved far enough away from Brexit?
I think we have. But I've enjoyed, though. This is the third and final of our Brexit trilogy, our loose Brexit trilogy. And we here at the Extremos Experiment can now park Brexit. We've done that. I think we've covered it in enough depth. But they were enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm very glad we did those Enoch Powell ones. I found them very interesting. As I say, it's a masterclass in a politician answering a question without giving an answer.
A lot of people say you're a racialist. Would you admit in any sense of the word to being a racialist?
First of all, I must define it. Because if by being a racialist you mean be conscious of differences between men and nations, some of which coincide with differences of race, then we're all racialist, I would have thought. But if by a racialist you mean a man who despises a human being because he belongs to another race, or a man who believes that one race is inherently superior to another in civilization or capability of civilization, then the answer is emphatically no.
But on that note, I shall sign us off. Thank you very much for staying the course with us on a slightly longer than usual episode, but we hope you've enjoyed it. And we'd urge you to go out, well, I wouldn't urge you to go and watch Curry and Chips, but everything we've watched today is well worth your time. We'll be back soon with another edition.
Bye now.
The Exton-Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.